Hello and welcome to Word Theatre Weekly, where each Saturday we share selections from our archive of performances of the world's best stories, recorded live in Los Angeles, New York, and London, brought to life by great actors and musicians. I'm your host, Cedaring Fox, Word Theatre's founder and artistic director. Please note that Word Theatre holds the copyright to these recordings, so no portion of anything you hear may be reproduced without permission. We have a big story this week, In the Cosmos, where we come from, where we are, and where we are going. This show, produced with musical director and composer Star Parodi, composer Jonathan Sachs, and conducted by the phenomenal Anthony Parthner, featured an extraordinary cast of actors and musicians, and was presented to a sold-out crowd in a beautiful 1,200-seat amphitheater here in Los Angeles, 5 days after the last major solar eclipse in 2017. I created this show in honor of my father, David Fox, who organized several total eclipse trips for friends and family during his lifetime. He was here in the audience to experience this, and I have to say, he was proud of me. Today, we will share the first half, and next week we will share the second half, and each will be online for 2 months for your listening pleasure. Here now is the first half of In the Cosmos, where we come from, where we are, and where we're going.
To In the Cosmos, ladies and gentlemen, welcome one and all. Where we come from, where we are, and where we're going.
The gods did not reveal from the beginning all things to us, but in the course of time, through seeking, we may learn and know things better. But as for certain truth, no man has known it, nor shall he know it, neither of the gods, nor yet of all the things of which I speak, for even if by chance he were to utter the final truth, he would himself not know it. For all is but a woven web of guesses.
Xenophanes of Solophon, Greek philosopher, 570 to 478 BC.
The universe is not only queerer than we suppose, it is queerer than we can suppose.
J.B.S. Haldane, 20th century British-born Indian scientist.
Man must rise above the earth, to the top of the atmosphere and beyond, for only then will he fully understand the world in which he lives.
Socrates, 5th century Athenian philosopher, renowned for his contributions to the field of ethics, as recorded by Plato.
As poets over the centuries concentrated on Grecian urns, nightingales, ravens, and romantic love, I am certain that poets in the future will concentrate on the configuration of the planets, stars, weightlessness, and the discovery of our universe.
Maya Angelou, author of I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings.
Like most fathers, by clear star-studded skies, I used to take each of my two little boys in my arms for a glimpse at infinity. The splendor of the unreachable silenced their chatterboxes for a few seconds. They raised their arms and closed their little fingers in a futile attempt to grasp one of the twinkling sparks that dot our dreams. The little fellows obeyed the command reported by Ovid. God elevated man's forehead and ordered him to contemplate the stars.
Captain Jacques-Yves Cousteau, French explorer, conservationist, filmmaker, innovator, and oceanographer.
Your dreams will take you very far. But when you wish upon a dream, oh, life ain't always what it seems. You see your night so clear.
It is clear to everyone that astronomy, at all events, compels the soul to look upwards and draws it from the things of this world to the other.
Plato, one of the world's most widely studied philosophers, he was the student of Socrates and the teacher of Aristotle.
Of all the sciences cultivated by mankind, astronomy is acknowledged to be, and undoubtedly is, the most sublime, the most interesting, and the most useful. For by knowledge derived from this science, not only the bulk of the earth is discovered, but our very faculties are enlarged with the grandeur of the ideas it conveys, our minds exalted above their low, contracted prejudices.
James Ferguson, British author of Astronomy explained upon Sir Isaac Newton's principles and made easy to those who have not studied mathematics. London, 1757.
The space age is upon us. People have visited the moon. Dozens of space probes have been sent on interplanetary missions to study planets, stars, galaxies. When you gaze up at the night sky, we now know that you are seeing stars that are millions of light years away, meaning it took the light from those stars millions of years to get here.
Night after night, the stars are there. And night after night, they call to us.
The cosmos is the setting for the greatest story ever told. And almost every day, science brings us new stories to help us understand our place in the universe.
Cosmology is among the oldest subjects to captivate our species. And it's no wonder. We're storytellers, and what could be more grand than the story of creation?
We all love a good story. We all love a tantalizing mystery. We all love the underdog pressing onward against seemingly insurmountable odds.
We all, in one form or another, are trying to make sense of the world around us.
The story is among the grandest, the unfolding of the entire universe.
The mystery is among the toughest, finding out how the cosmos came to be.
The odds are among the most daunting, bipeds newly arrived by cosmic timescales, trying to reveal the secrets of the ages.
And the quest is among the deepest.
The search for fundamental laws to explain all we see and beyond. From the tiniest particles to the most distant galaxies.
The Elegant Universe by author Brian Greene, American theoretical physicist, mathematician, and string theorist.
How can one describe the moment of creation in human language? All we know is that from what may have been nothing, we go to a state of almost infinite density, an infinite temperature, and infinite violence.
Understanding how nothing turned into something may be the greatest mystery of our universe. But when you understand that that is a mystery, you start to understand the Big Bang, when time and space began, and the great big explosion that created everything.
On the opening page of his new book, Astrophysics for People in a Hurry, renowned contemporary cosmologist and director of the Hayden Planetarium, Neil deGrasse Tyson writes,
"In the beginning, nearly 14 billion years ago, all the space, all the matter, all the energy of the known universe was contained in a volume, in a speck so small that it's hard to even imagine. Conditions were so hot, the basic forces of nature that collectively described the universe were unified. Though still unknown how it came into existence, this pinpoint size cosmos could only expand rapidly in what today we call the Big Bang.
Scientists think it took less than a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a millionth of a second for the universe to expand from the size of an atom to a baseball.
That may not sound like much, but it's like a golf ball expanding to the size of the Earth in the same amount of time.
Billion years ago, when the universe let rip and, in disciplined panic, creation spewed mazy star treacle and resin, shrinking balls of debut fire smoldered and glitched. Revolving tantrums tore themselves in, kernel tight, then cooler, began shooting off their planets like a brace of dandelions gone to seed. Even stars don't live forever. Old age makes the outer region redden and swell. Betelgeuse's radiant flesh in Orion is as much a death spurt as a whale's flower of blood. Like a body, a star grows larger as it runs down. Neptune once flecked a coral sun, yellow now as a scrub diamond, that will puff beet red in 5 billion years and suck the planets back to where they began.
Diane Ackerman, from her poem Neptune.
What we humans are looking for in a creation story is a way of experiencing the world that will open to us the transcendent that informs us and at the same time forms ourselves within it. That is what people want. That is what the soul asks for.
American mythologist Joseph Campbell.
Who are we? And where did we come from? How were people and the universe created? These are questions as old as humankind, and our answers have been told in stories just as varied as the human imagination.
The Enuma Elish, the Babylonian creation myth, is the earliest written creation myth in which the god Marduk battles the chaos goddess Tiamat and her evil minions. Tiamat takes the form of a gigantic snake, and Marduk battles and defeats her using an arsenal of super weapons. After his victory, Marduk is made the leader of the gods by acclamation. Marduk divides Tiamat's corpse into two portions. Her upper half becomes the sky, and her lower half, the earth. Marduk then destroys Tiamat's husband, Kingu, and uses his blood and bones to create humankind to do the work for the gods.
What's surprising is not how the world's creation stories differ, but how much they have in common, even when they originate in vastly different places. Here is a myth from China that answers the question about the origin of life.
In the beginning, there was the cosmic egg, a huge egg containing all the opposites, hot and cold, light and dark, wet and dry. Inside the egg, which floated on a formless sea of chaos, the infant god Fan Ku resided for almost an eternity. Fan Ku broke forth from the egg as a giant covered in hair. He had horns on his head and tusks sprang from his mouth.
Tenku broke out of the egg and separated the opposites through all the world. He grew enormously, over 10 feet per day, so the top half of the eggshell became the sky, and the bottom half, the earth. He carved out the mountains and the oceans with his chisel and mallet. After 18,000 years, Fanku died to give birth to our world. His flesh, soil, and blood became the rivers. His breath became the wind. His eyes became the sun and the moon. And the fleas in his hair became human beings.
The Fanku myth mirrors a theme found in many other religions and ancient mythologies, that the universe sprang into existence. Creation ex nihilo, created from nothing. In Egypt, it was said that
from the beginning of time, there was only Nun, the dark waters of chaos. The sun god, Atum, the first god, rose up from the chaotic waters with his thoughts and will. With no place to stand in the watery chaos where he appeared, Atum created a hill. Then Atum coughed and spat out Shu, the god of the air, and Tefnut, the goddess of moisture. Shu and Tefnut had two children, Geb, the god of the earth, and Nut, the goddess of the sky. Shu lifted up her daughter Nut so that she became a canopy over Geb.
And in Greece...
Okay. So, the short answer to how the Greeks viewed the creation of the world is this. Scary old gods came first. They got stomped down by their kids, who were better looking younger gods. These gods created humans. And humans and gods fought for supremacy. And you know, the humans won a couple of rounds, but eventually got trounced and became more and more miserable, blah, blah, blah.
The Greeks believed that the world was flat, but circular, like a dinner plate. All at the center of the universe was Greece. Their world was divided by the Mediterranean, which in Latin means middle of the lands. The river, ocean, flowed around the world in a clockwise motion. In the north lived the Hyperboreans, an extremely happy people for whom life was sweet. In the south lived the Ethiopians in Ethiopia, meaning really far away. And to the west were the Elysian Fields. And this was the closest the Greeks got to the idea of heaven. Only the best and the brightest of the dead got to go there.
And then Aristotle came along. As long ago as 340 BC, Aristotle, in his book On the Heavens, put forward three good arguments for believing that the earth was a round ball rather than a flat plate.
First, Aristotle realized that eclipses of the moon were caused by the earth coming between the sun and the moon. The earth's shadow on the moon was always round, which would be true only if the earth was spherical.
Second, the Greeks knew from their travels that the pole star appeared lower in the sky when viewed in the south than it did in more northerly regions.
Third, why else does one first see the sails of a ship coming over the horizon and only later see the hull?
Aristotle also proposed the idea of a geocentric universe wherein the sun and all the stars revolved around the earth.
In the 3rd century BC, Aristarchus of Samos, a Greek mathematician and astronomer, was the first to contradict Aristotle by proposing a sun-centered universe.
You, King Galan, are aware the universe is the name given by most astronomers to the sphere, the center of which is the center of the Earth, while its radius is equal to the straight line between the center of the sun and the center of the Earth. This is the common account, as you've heard from astronomers. But Aristarchus has brought out a book consisting of certain hypotheses wherein it appears, as a consequence of the assumptions made, that the universe is many times greater than the universe just mentioned. His hypotheses are that the fixed stars and the sun remain unmoved, that the Earth revolves around the sun on the circumference of a circle, the sun lying in the middle of the floor, and the sphere of the fixed stars, situated about the same center as the sun, is so great that the circle in which he supposes the Earth to revolve bears such a proportion to the distance of the fixed stars as the center of the sphere bears to its surface.
Aristarchus thus believed the stars to be very, very far away. Much further away than was generally assumed in ancient times. And since there were no telescopes, his speculation, although accurate, was unprovable, and therefore rejected, leaving Aristotle's model of a geocentric universe to prevail for the next 1,800 years.
Told you.
Deep in the human unconscious is a pervasive need for a logical universe that makes sense. But the real universe is always one step beyond logic.
Frank Herbert, from his epic science fiction novel, Dune.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, and God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. And God saw that the light was good. And God separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day.
The Christian creation myth, Book of Genesis.
Oh, deep thought computer,
Fuchs said.
The task we have designed you to perform is this. We want you to tell us.
He paused.
The answer.
The answer,
said Deep Thought.
The answer to what?
To life,
urged Fook.
The universe,
said Lunkwill.
Everything,
they said in chorus. Deep Thought paused for a moment's reflection.
Tricky,
he said finally.
But can you
do it?
They asked in unison. Again, a significant pause.
Yes,
said Deep Thought.
I can do it.
There is an answer?
Said Fook with breathless excitement.
Yes,
said Deep Thought.
Life, the universe, and everything. There is an answer. But I'll have to think about it.
Fook glanced impatiently at his watch.
How long?
He said.
7.5 million years,
said Deep Thought. Lunkwill and Fook blinked at each other.
Seven and a half million years?
They cried in chorus.
Yes!
Declaimed Deep Thought.
I said I'd have to think about it, didn't I?
7.5 million years later, Fook and Lunkwill are long gone, but their ancestors continue what they started.
We are the ones who will hear,
said Fuchink,
the answer to the great question of life.
The universe,
said Lunkwill.
And everything.
Shh,
said Lunkwill with a slight gesture.
I think Deep Thought is preparing to speak.
There was a moment's expectant pause while panels slowly came to life on the front of the console. Lights flashed on and off experimentally, and settle down into a businesslike pattern. A soft, low hum came over the communication channel.
Good morning, said Deep Thought at last.
Good morning, Deep Thought,
said Lun Kual nervously.
Do you have, that is...
An answer for you?
Interrupted Deep Thought majestically.
Yes, I have.
The two shivered with expectancy. Their waiting had not been in vain.
There really is one?
Breathed Fuch.
There really is one.
Confirmed Deep Thought.
To everything? To the great question of life, the universe, and everything?
Asked Lun Kual.
Yes.
Both of the men had been trained for this moment. Their lives had been a preparation for it. They had been selected at birth as those who would witness the answer. But even so, they found themselves gasping and squirming like excited children.
And you're ready to give it to us?
Urged Lun Kual.
I am.
Now?
Asked Fu.
Now,
said Deep Thought. They both licked their dry lips.
Though I don't think,
added Deep Thought,
that you're going to like it.
It doesn't matter,
said Fuch.
We must know it now.
Now?
Inquired Deep Thought.
Yes, now!
All right, said the computer, and settled into silence again. The two men fidgeted. The tension was unbearable.
You're really not going to like it,
observed Deep Thought.
Tell us.
All right,
said Deep Thought.
The answer to the great question.
Yes?
Of life, the universe, and everything,
said Deep Thought.
Yes?
Is,
said Deep Thought, and paused.
Yes?
Is?
Yes!
42.
Said Deep Thought, with infinite majesty and calm.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams. Who also said...
Beethoven tells you what it's like to be Beethoven. Mozart tells you what it's like to be human. And Bach tells you what it's like to be the universe.
Thank you.
In the second century AD, Claudius Ptolemy, who considered the most influential astronomer and geographer of Roman times, wrote the Almagest, a synthesis of the Greek view of the universe. We know few details of Ptolemy's life, but he left one personal poem.
Well do I know that I am mortal, a creature of one day. But if my mind follows the wandering path of stars, then my feet no longer rest on earth. But standing by Zeus himself, I take my fill of ambrosia, the food of the gods.
Based on observations he made with his naked eye, Ptolemy saw the universe as a set of nested, transparent spheres with Earth in the center. He posited that
the moon, Mercury, Venus, and the sun all revolve around Earth. Beyond the sun sit Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn.
The only other planets known at that time, as they were visible to the naked eye. Beyond Saturn lay
a final sphere, with all the stars fixed to it, that revolves around the other spheres.
Ptolemy's model provided a reasonably accurate system for predicting planetary positions and solar and lunar eclipses. But in order to predict these positions correctly, Ptolemy had to make an assumption that the moon followed a path that sometimes brought it twice as close to the Earth than at other times. And that meant that the moon should be on those occasions appear twice as big, which it didn't. Ptolemy recognized this flaw, but nevertheless, his model was generally, although not universally, accepted. The Almagest was translated into Latin in the 12th century, enabling Ptolemy's teachings to be spread throughout Western Europe, where the Christian church eagerly adopted them. You see, he offered a picture of the universe that was in accordance with scripture, for it left lots of room outside the sphere of fixed stars for heaven and hell.
Both brilliant mathematician astronomers from India and the Middle East in the 5th through 11th centuries, including Aryabhata, Albomassar, and Al-Sijizi, proposed a sun-centered universe. It wasn't until many centuries later that the heliocentric theory was successfully revived by Copernicus, after which Johannes Kepler described planetary motions based on geometric laws, and Isaac Newton gave a theoretical explanation based on laws of force and universal gravitational attraction.
The scholarly work in Europe during the Dark Ages, roughly from the fall of Rome in the 5th century through about 1100, had been primarily concerned with the copying of church manuscripts. As this ancient learning began to reach Europe, it was first studied in the cathedral schools, which evolved into the first universities, with colleges in Cambridge and Oxford in England, for example, being founded in the 13th century.
The flood of ancient pagan knowledge into Europe through the translations from Hebrew and Arabic produced a crisis for Christian theologians. How could one accept a world philosophy that predated the Christian faith?
For a time, this anxiety was quelled by the integration of Greek rationality with Christian monotheism under Thomas Aquinas. The all-seeing God of Christianity created the world in an ordered, logical fashion as related in the biblical book of Genesis. Therefore, it was only natural to look for a rational explanation of the phenomena of nature.
However, during the Renaissance, Aquinas' integration of Greek and particularly Aristotelian philosophy with Catholic theology eventually led to as many problems for the church as it had solved.
In 1514, a Polish priest, Nicholas Copernicus, put forth his model, showing that the sun was stationary at the center and that the earth and the planets moved in circular orbits around the sun.
Copernicus feared his findings would be considered heresy as they challenged the authority of the church by questioning the hierarchical structure on which its entire existence was based. If the earth was not stationary at the center of the universe, perhaps heaven was not outside the sphere of the stars. And where did this leave God? Not to mention all of his ecclesiastical delegates.
The idea of a moving earth was so revolutionary that Copernicus did not agree to have it published until he was on his deathbed, 3 decades later.
Here, Steve Cedering, in her suite of poems, Letters from the Astronomers, imagines an elderly and frustrated Copernicus saying these words.
The sun is the center of the universe. The planets move around the sun. Yesterday, when I went riding, it began to snow. The seasons change. The earth turns on its axis. Share these ideas with your students, but don't give them my name. New continents are being discovered. Books are being printed. Witches burn. I am afraid of the spirit of the times. What will they do if I say the sun is the center of this cosmic temple, if I say its distance from the earth is infinitesimal compared to the distance between the earth and the stars? I carry a pouch of powdered unicorn's horn and red sandalwood to cure the ill. I have devised a new monetary system. I was asked to Rome to help create a new calendar, but I declined. My mathematics are not sufficient. If you have been trained in the art, see if you can find the laws that would prove my ideas. Do you have a quadrant, an armillary sphere, an astrolabe?
Would you believe that nearly another century passed before Copernicus's idea was taken seriously?
Crazy, right? In the latter part of the 16th century, 1800 years after Aristarchus first proposed the idea of a heliocentric universe, Galileo Galilei heard of the invention of the telescope and designed and built one for himself.
This first telescope, usable for astronomical observations, quickly led Galileo to realize that Copernicus's theory was more than just an alternative to the Ptolemaic approach for calculating the positions of the planets.
He saw with his own eyes that Jupiter had moons whose positions shifted every day, and he realized that this was a miniature model of the solar system. Venus showed phases similar to those of the moon.
As it must under the Copernicus system.
The moon had mountains similar to Earth.
God's heavens were mutable and therefore imperfect. He said, quite famously,
I do not feel obliged to believe that the same God who has endowed us with sense, reason, and intellect has intended us to forego their use.
No wonder the church saw him as a threat.
Galileo, aged 68, was tried by the Inquisition, and two worlds came into cosmic conflict. The world of science and humanism collided with the world of scholasticism and absolutism that held power in the Catholic Church.
In his 1633 trial, Galileo famously quoted Cardinal Baronius.
The Bible teaches us how to go to heaven, not how the heavens go.
Galileo was found
vehemently suspect of heresy.
Namely, of having held the opinions that the sun lies motionless at the center of the universe, that the earth is not at its center and moves, and that one may hold and defend an opinion as probable after it had been declared contrary to Holy Scripture. He was required to
abjure, curse, and detest
those opinions.
For daring to support Copernicus's theory, even though he recanted when faced with the death penalty, Galileo was sentenced to house arrest for the remainder of his life.
They say I was arrogant. Well, I was. I had come far from my father's numbers and songs. Before me, no one had seen the moons of Jupiter, the phases of Venus, the mountains of the moon. Now I am tired of arguing with Jesuits and Aristotelians. I have renounced my views on the Copernican universe. I have denounced my students and friends. My book is condemned. I cannot put my mind at ease. I have trouble sleeping. My daughter Virginia reads the prescribed penitential psalms. What is Christianity that it can be threatened? The sun is turning on its axis. I am old. I am going blind.
Steve Cedaring, Letters from the Astronomers.
Whenever life gets you down, Mrs. Brown, and things seem hard, tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's revolving and revolving at 100 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 million miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 500,000 miles an hour of this galaxy we call the Milky Way. Galaxy itself contains 500 million stars. It's 100,000 light years side to side. It bulges in the middle, 6,000 light years thick. But out by us, it's just 1,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years. And our galaxy is one of only millions of millions in this amazing and expanding universe. On expanding and expanding in act of all the directions it can whiz. as fast as it can go. The speed of light, you know. 12 million miles a minute, and that's the fastest speed there is. So remember, when you're feeling very small and insecure, how amazingly unlikely is your birth. And pray that there's intelligent life somewhere up in space, because there's bugger all down here on Earth.
From the one and only English comedy group, Monty Python. Galaxy Song, sometimes called the Universe Song.
If you're enjoying Word Theater Weekly, please tell your friends about us and make sure to tune in next week for the second half of In the Cosmos. It's time to wrap it up. So, as always, I'd like to thank philanthropist benefactor Ola Strom, Glass Animals for our theme music, the LA County Department of Arts and Culture for their ongoing support of this podcast, and thank you to all our wonderful interns, including our graphics intern, Yang Yang Huang, our podcast intern, Riley Fox, our video intern, Vincent Paz, our literary intern, Olivia Green, our executive coordinator, Scout Riley, and always, our podcast editor, Jason Lee. If you couldn't make it Friday, April 12th, to our phenomenal evening with George Saunders and his stories, become a member. You'll be able to stream a filmed version of the show on your members page as soon as it's edited. Simply visit wordtheater.org/membership to join us, and you'll receive perks all throughout the year, no matter where you live. Until next week, this is Cedaring Fox, signing off.